Welcome to Galley Tables, sharing stories and sharing life. Each month, Galley Table Storytelling hosts a live event in the Kodiak community. Storytellers are given 7 minutes to tell a personal story related to a monthly theme. Tonight, we're going to hear those stories.
And the plane took off. And we weren't going to see that pilot again for 3 weeks. So this is before InReach. This is before sat phones. This is before cell phones, of course. And we didn't have a radio. So for those 3 weeks, Randy and I were going to be completely reliant on each other. Anything went wrong, there was no one we could tell about each other. And importantly to the story, we had no way to get weather information. So there would be no storm warning. So the next day, Randy and I set up Mount Hess, and the first day is 3,000 feet of pretty moderate terrain, and it's just beautiful bluebird skies. At the end of the day, we get up to this little perch on top of the ridge on the mountain, which is just enough room to dig a flat platform for a tiny little mountain tent. And we're looking out at all the mountains and glaciers all around us, this beautiful mountain wilderness all to ourselves, and there's just nowhere we'd rather be. So we go to sleep, and we get up the next day, and we get up super, super, super early, alpine style, hours before sunrise, and we start climbing. And this turns out to be one of the most demanding, beautiful, rewarding days of my climbing life. We're climbing along this ridge, it's double corniced, so the wind blows across the mountain and builds a cornice of snow that's cantilevered out over the glacier, and this ridge has those cornices going in both directions. Sort of winding our way through, and the game is if you get up too far in the cornice, your weight's going to collapse and you'll fall down to the glacier below. But if you're too low, you risk the avalanche danger. So there's this perfect spot that you want to find. We go along that and we get to the end of that ridge and we come to this ice face. We climb up the ice face, pitch after pitch after pitch after pitch. And it's this beautiful exposed perch way up in the mountains. And we're kicking our crampons into the ice and knocking chunks of ice down the mountain wall. And just looking down and watching that ice just fall and fall and fall for thousands of feet, and there's nowhere we'd rather be. It's just perfect. And we get to the top of that mountain face, and we're on the summit ridge, and we can see the summit in front of us, and what we see is that there's no difficult climbing left. It's just a walk from here to the summit. And we look at that, and we know we failed. Because it's too late. You gotta climb safely, but you gotta climb fast. And we realize we don't have time to get to that summit and get back to our tent before dark. So we turn around, you rappel down that ice face, you chop anchors, put an ice horn in ice, put webbing over the horn of ice, put our ropes through it, lower ourselves down. We do that time after time after time. We get to the cornice ridge, retrace our steps very carefully. Halfway along the cornice ridge, night falls. Even though we didn't go to the summit, we were still too slow, so we put on our headlamps. And we climbed so carefully. This is something like a 14-hour day. We were exhausted. We climbed hard all day. The very end, we're so careful. Pick our way, not make a mistake in the dark. And we get back to our tent. And the sky is beautiful, full of stars. This is when Hale Bopp was in the sky over Alaska. So I have this wonderful memory of being half in my sleeping bag, half in this tiny mountain tent, cooking on our little stove outside of the tent, watching the comet. And I cooked up all the rest of our food for dinner. We were so hungry. We carried very little food because weight is so important when we're climbing. We have all the food in the world down the glacier. We knew we were going down the next day. We went to sleep. And we woke up to a storm. Tent was just rattling. Snow was hitting the tent wall like handfuls of babies. And that's important because that easy 3,000 feet that had gotten us up to the tent site was all perfectly angled to avalanche. It's all 35 degrees. So we knew we couldn't go down because it was loading up with snow. It wouldn't be safe. So we just had to lay there. No food. But we had tons of fuel because we needed fuel for our stove to melt snow to make water to drink. If you don't drink water in the Alaska region, you get frostbite. So we always carry tons of fuel. So we just lay there in our sleeping bags in a tiny tent all day, sitting in water, getting hungrier and hungrier. And this is where I should tell you something important about Randy, which is that Randy is from North Dakota. And Randy speaks like a North Dakotan, which means he doesn't speak. North Dakotans are really laconic, so we just lay in our sleeping bags, not saying anything, go to sleep with our hearts full of hope. Wake up the next morning, the storm's still raging. Snow's building up around the tent, threatening to collapse, so we have to get up and dig it out. Our body heat's melting off the ice beneath us, so we're starting to roll into each other. I see you guys getting really annoyed with each other. Hungry, hunger, cold. Last all through the day, go to sleep at night with our hearts full of hope. And you wake up the next morning, and it's clear. Bluebird skies, big pillow of snow all around, on the mountain, all around us. We look out, Randy looks at the snow, and he says, we can't go down. Randy was doing mountain savvy. He says, the biggest avalanche danger is within 24 hours of a storm event. We can't cross these pressure load slopes. We gotta wait. So we get back in our sleeping bags, and all during that bluebird day, we sip water and get hungry and hungry. It's the third day without food. We're really hungry. We go to bed. Our hearts full of hope. And around midnight, I wake up and another storm has started. Our tent is rattling in the wind. And I'm just laying there wide awake, and I can tell Randy's awake, and he can tell I'm awake, and we're not saying anything. It's not because he's from North Dakota, but it's because there's nothing to say. We know we're in a really bad position. It's been 3 days without food. We are getting weak. We're just pretty seriously hungry. We have to eat. But we also, these slopes are loading up, and we can't cross the slopes to get down to the glacier. So it makes for a pretty sleepless night. So we woke up the next morning, and I unzipped the tent, and I looked out, and I saw this miraculous sight, which is I saw all of our footprints, where we walked up to our tent site all those days before, but they weren't footprints down into the snow, they were pedestals of snow. So what happened is we compressed the snow on our way up, and that second storm during the night wasn't a snowstorm, it was just a windstorm. It had blown the slopes clear of snow, and all of us left and saw our footprints coming up. We were ecstatic. God dressed really fast. Packed up the tent, running down, or sort of staggering down, big-headed and hungry, down to the glacier where all the food in the world awaited us. And we were really happy until we got the last 500 feet. And that had been blown clear. It had been loaded up with snow. We could see our cache, all our supplies of food, half a mile away. And we didn't talk about it much, there wasn't much to say. We had to get there to eat. And the only way to do it was to cross that slope. So we started walking. And we kicked this avalanche. And that avalanche was not underneath us. That avalanche was not above us. That avalanche was next to us. This big crack was shooting out next to Randy on the slope, 3 feet deep, 500 feet long, tens of thousands of tons of snow, just went roaring down that mountain and started packing into the crevasse between the glacier and the mountainside, filling it. The slide stopped, and the cloud of snow settled, and Randy let out this huge whoop of joy. Because we knew that avalanche slope that just slipped was totally safe. So we just stepped over onto it. It was just like styrofoam snow. We just ran down, got to our cache of food, and ate until we went to sleep.
Amanda Knudsen.
Knudsen.
You say the K. Okay. Knudsen. She was born in Washington State, I presume. And this is her first year in Alaska and her first year of teaching. She's at Peterson. She enjoys, but this is for fun, sewing and writing IEPs. Any miscellaneous details are that she has a dog and his name is Tucker. Thank you.
So, not all storms are at sea, and not all storms are real. Mine's more of a metaphorical storm. My parents are lovely, and they have a lovely marriage, but it can be a little stormy, mostly because of my father's earnest attempts to drive my mother crazy. My father is very good at this, and it's a shock my mother's still mostly sane. His attempts to drive her crazy started early in their marriage, actually before they were even married. My dad is the only male child on that side of the family, so the pressure to reproduce was immense. His aunts were after him, get married, Bill, get married, get married. So he said, fine, I will get a wife. I will find one, and I will bring her home next week. You watch. So my father comes home the next week and introduces the family to his wife, a tiny Brittany Spaniel puppy that he has named Wife. Wife lived till I was 8. So, apparently if you want to get married, you should find a dog and name it the spouse you're looking for. Wife was a bird dog, and she was very bad at it. Dad would take her hunting on public land in eastern Washington when I was really small, and she would go out and grab the bird and then never bring it back. So there my father is in the bushes of eastern Washington screaming at his dog, Wife, you stupid female dog. Get over here, you stupid animal. I need that, in the Lord's name in vain, bird over here right now. And I can only imagine what the stories people went home with. Honey, you think you have it bad? I go hunting every weekend. Some guy had his wife out there fetching birds. These attempts to drive my mother crazy continued when we, after he had children. I'm the oldest, and so his idea of babysitting me was sticking me on the front seat of his pickup and letting me stand there, which was great until I figured out how to put it into gear and ran it into the garage. And from the house, you hear my mother, the most storm warning of my childhood, her scream. You see, she'd been told, don't yell at your husband. When you're mad at him, compliment him. So my mother would yell, Bill, you are so good looking. And my dad knew he was in trouble. He didn't learn his lesson, though. He stuck my brother on the front seat of the same pickup. But he didn't bring it down the hill. He hotwired the horn permanently on. Dad fixed it, though, or so we thought. So Mom took the pickup and headed into town. And everything was great until she made her first right-hand turn. And the horn goes, honk! Okay, did I hit the horn? Nope. Next right-hand turn, honk! You are so good looking. My poor father wasn't even there for that one. Grandma had to disconnect the horn. We never fixed it. But the biggest time my father got in trouble was when he took my brother to the hairdresser. My aunt's a beautician, and she decided she was going to do my brother's hair like she always had. But my brother had other problems. He had a perchance for eating lemons. And so his very front tooth right here had mostly dissolved, but we hadn't made it to the dentist yet. It was brown and black and ugly, and as a beautician, my aunt couldn't put up with that. So she took her nail drill, drilled his tooth out, and filled it full of nail acrylic. It didn't hurt my brother. The tooth was dead. But nonetheless, when my brother got home with my father, you heard, Bill, you are so good looking.
crochet, and you may have seen her performing acro routines in Little School of Dance recitals. Please welcome to the stage, Bridget.
job, Brittany. So many times in my life when there's been a warning, I don't pay any attention. Storm warning, gale warning, gentle warning. I don't listen, I don't pay heed. When I first got to Air Station Kodiak in 1977, I was the only female there, and this kind gentleman gave me a gentle warning. Commissioned Warrant Officer, Mr. Cornelius Van Zwalenberg. He says to me, now Sandra, Coast Guard is a very small organization. Aviation is even a smaller group. Whatever you do, probably everything you do, will be noticed and remembered for a very long time. Good, listen to that. That was a good warning. So there were, in fact, a lot of things that I did. You don't have time. And when I first showed up here, I was married to a fellow named Paul Wardlow. There's many bad reasons to get married. We chose the one where when you get married, you get Coast Guard hazard. Paul Wardlow was found to have a pound of marijuana in Coast Guard housing, so he left, and I went to the barracks. Then there was this story about when we flew out to Navy Air Station ADAC. Yep. And the whole crew had to be escorted to the brig. There was something, I don't know, drunk, disorderly, something about trying to steal the tow truck so that we could get our van out of the snow. I don't know. But, you know, it was embarrassing then. And just as CWO, Mr. Cornelius Van Zwalenberg, explained to me, it was going to be embarrassing in the future. So now we're at 1999. And it was a cold winter Alcan trip. My son was in the States. He wanted someone to come up with him. I was nominated. But my husband, Red, who I actually listen to, you know, more often than others, he explained to me, now Sandra, this is not a family vacation, right? And you are not in charge. This is Roy's trip. It's Roy's truck. He wants you for companionship and a credit card. I met Roy in Chicago. We take off after dinner. It's late, about 4 a.m. We're going to Minneapolis. No third gear. So we find a transmission place, wait a couple hours till they open up, and thanks to Amco and Mom's credit card, we got a new transmission. Now, this is probably the only part you're going to remember of this story. It has nothing to do with storm warning. So we spend the day, and we take off driving up north, and I gotta pee. I say, hey, boy, you know me, when you pull over, I pee. No, Emma, you just gonna have to hold it. And I'm thinking, okay, so how are we gonna cooperate on this? How's this gonna go? You know, I'm thinking, and I get it. I said, hey, Roy, this is your truck, and this is your truck seat. Ma's gotta pee. You can pull over or not. He saw the light. Then it was the border crossing, right? Simple, right? Give your ID, check it out. Did you pull over, please? And I didn't say. Mrs. West, can you come into this other room? No, Roy, you can stay right there. So they're asking me all these questions. You know, what's your name? What's your name? Do you have other names? Yeah. Where are you born? I mean, they're just asking all these questions. And then it comes. Have you ever been convicted? Why didn't you know what that meant? I've been so close so many times.
I didn't know that.
And I was convicted at that point by the Holy Spirit, and I just spilled all the beans. I said, there was this time, you know? I went from Canada into the U.S. with my friend, and there was something in the car that, you know, they confiscated the car, we had to hitchhike, borrow some money, come back. But I... No, he says, you aren't convicted. I said, then there's another time, like I said, you know, we had ADAC, and we all went to the brig, and the pilots had to come and bail us out, and we could do the mission. No, that wasn't it. So, turns out that they had me ask questions because my maiden name is Ward, then I married Mr. Wardlow, then I married Mr. West, and they thought they were aliases, and that I was really up to something. Look at this face. No, I wasn't. You know, it was embarrassing back then, and it was embarrassing again. Sometimes it's hard to tell those stories of when you were stupid. But by the grace of God, and because of Jesus Christ, I can say that's who I was, and this is who I am now. And, you know, I was wild and worse, but I know that I am greatly loved by Him, and should have listened to Mr. Cornelius as well.
This is the quietest you guys have ever been after intermission. I am so proud. Okay, our next storyteller is Michael Curtis. He was born in Nebraska, North Platte. He is in the Coast Guard. He's a deckie for the Coast Guard cutter Alex Haley. He likes to hike and free climb, and he's lived in Kodiak for 1 year, and he still gets seasick very easily. Please welcome to the stage Michael Curtis.
Well, the good news is at least the microphone's to my height this time, and not that problem. As you all know, my name is Michael Curtis, and a lot of people have talked about storm warnings, whether it be actual storms or with their families. I'm going to talk about a storm warning that comes once a year, and it's during the springtime, and it is called spring cleaning. Now, in order to get into the story, I want to first take you on a trip that my grandmother told me 3 hours before I decided to come up on stage to talk about this. My mother has always been a very interesting cleaner. She is... known for being exotic with her cleaning. In fact, my grandma calls it the scoop shovel method, if you may say so yourself. My grandmother would go into my mother's room, and it would be dirty, and she'd say, you need to clean your room, Stacy. And then, as my mother would do, she would throw every single thing outside of her room, and then it would come back in, and it would look beautiful. We don't know how. It just worked. So, of course, the techniques work, and when techniques work, you keep them going. 20, 25, 30 years later, my mother is still doing the same technique, and now she has a big house, and me, and a stepfather, and a bunch of other people in the household, too. And it is always a very interesting time, because when spring cleaning comes around, my mother gets agitated. So much so that I have called my grandmother screaming, please give me work, I want to leave now! I'm very terrified of my mother when she spring cleans. In fact, I get so terrified. I try my best to stay away from the house. She is known for doing, as I said, the scoop shovel method, but she's also likes to throw things. And I don't know if you all have ever dealt with the drill sergeant of a mother, but I never knew my mom as someone who could scream or yell until the first time I seen her spring cleaning and I could actually realize it. She had come up to me, and I came inside the house, and she was spring cleaning, doing her and across the full hallway, I watch a frying pan fly through our window, breaking the window and causing a lot of terrifying. I walked back outside and went to my car and left. I was not coming inside. She's always known like for doing the most exotic things I've ever seen. Like, and she doesn't like it when cleaning doesn't go her way. If cleaning doesn't go her way, it agitates her even more so. To the point where I've had one time, I was cleaning my room and I just wiping down the tables, doing the usual organization. And I hear my door open up, and I look over to my door, and I watch a trash can come flying in the door. at about 9,000 miles per hour, linting all the garbage all over my entire freshly cleaned room. She comes in and goes, I told you to take the trash out yesterday!
Yes, Mom. I'm sorry.
And as that kept going, I realized it just wasn't a good idea to mess with her when she was cleaning. Another time I realized this really quickly was about 3 years ago when I was 16. I was at that rebellious stage in life where you really don't understand not to mess with people when you're not supposed to. I was in the garage. She was cleaning, and we were hitting stumps with sledgehammers. They were inside the garage. It was really weird. I never understood. And I could not hit the stump to save my life. Like, I tried. I'd sit there. I'd swing. I'd miss. I'd hit it. I'd swing. I'd miss. And about the third time it happened, I threw the sledgehammer at the garage door. Which, in return, my mother grabbed me by my head and shook me like a WWE World Star champion would over her head. I should also mention I'm 280 pounds, and my mother is a former MMA fighter. It hurt! A lot! That was the day I learned, hey, it's probably not good to anger anymore. Did I still continue to do it? Yes. Did I learn from my lesson? No. Should I have? Yes. Life is always interesting with her, but she is just one of those people that is, overall, she's an amazing human being until she gets angry. And I cannot express enough how much cleaning just absolutely angers her. I don't know if it's just because of the scoop shovel method or the fact that it just doesn't go her way, but every single time it happens, again and again, my family always fears for their life. Whether it be me and my stepfather running away and going and working in the garage, to hearing a phone call 15 minutes later from her screaming at us to get inside the house to help her clean because she's been cleaning all day. This woman would literally take every single piece of furniture out of the house, bleach the entire household down to the bare minimum floors, and then bring everything back in. And the miraculous part was she would do it all by herself. I would kid you not, I'd come home and there would be a couch outside on the front porch, and the living room would be outside on the patio. I don't understand how it does it. I come home and there's just a totally different household. I feel like I live in a different household every time spring cleaning comes around. It's just amazing to me the things that can happen when my mother gets slightly agitated or angry. So, if I have to admit one thing and one thing I've learned alone, that is that the storm warning for this is do not mess with a mother when she's cleaning. Thank you.
Our next storyteller is Paul Moore. He was born in Coquille, Oregon. He came to Kodiak to work on a boat for 2 years, and that was 7 years ago. For fun, he does photography, plays music, golf, and travels, and he has a 15-year-old daughter playing the pep band for the wrestling match tonight. Please welcome Paul.
Alright, my storm warning started about noonday. My storm warning is about when I was abroad in China. We're heading to a factory, and to give you a little introduction about factory visits, it's not like a normal meeting. You go to a meeting room and you get a glass of water, you have a meeting, and you leave. Normally you get a tour of the factory, you have a meal, you get tea. It can take 2 to 3 hours sometimes. So we were planning for the evening of this factory. And the whole time there, the driver kept telling my boss, I didn't know the word he was saying, da shaliu. It turned out to be big rain. And it turns out to be the translation for monsoon. So we were going to have our first monsoon coming right where we were going to be traveling for the next couple hours. And so the meeting went as planned, first hour went through, and we get a text from the driver saying, I had to go to Starbucks. It was really weird, so my boss had me go out in the hallway and call him. So I called my driver and I said, what's going on? He said, I need Starbucks. That's the only Chinese I could catch out of it was, I need Starbucks. I still didn't know what he meant. So we finished our meeting, about another hour went by. This whole time it's been raining like it snowed today. It's been coming down nonstop. So we knew it was going to be a little bit of weather issues going home. But when we got out of the factory, the whole road coming in and out of town was now just a river. Literally just the whole river going through it. And we saw some brave soldiers walking through. And then we just saw just the whole line of people start walking through. Everything above their hands like this, water was waist high. And here's my boss and I, we had our computer, we're in suits. So we saw this little store here that was selling slippers. So we bought a pair of slippers, put our shoes in bags, and just started walking. We started walking across this room. Halfway through, the water's getting higher and higher, and we're looking at each other. Is this a smart move? You know. So we get there, get across the street, and we get our orientation back together. We look for our driver, we look for the Starbucks. It's on the other side over here, there's another road we had to cross, another river. Same thing, so we're walking across again, and we're just looking at each other like we're insane, we're crazy. We get to the Starbucks, the driver looks at us, we drive through, and it turns out the whole factory we were going, half of it got washed out. Another one we got through, half of it got washed out. I think three quarters of the town we're in is washed out. We're surrounded by these rivers everywhere. So I think the moral of our story was, sometimes you need Starbucks, you know, but sometimes you need to listen to your driver too.
Stops and waits for slack tide. You've got 1 hour to get through this pass. Well, with a log raft, now understand what logging is. They tied logs in 20 packed bundles with 2-inch banding, put 5 abreast, 20 long, and boom sticks all the way around it. They're tied together with boom chains. Big ring, kind of like your dog choker. You put the toggle through one side and then tie a shackle on, and you can make this big square wood barge made out of 1,000,000 board feet of lumber. Well, we're picking up logs. It's winter, it's close to the time. The weather's going south on us. When it blows southeast down there, it's bad. And we are going to replace all false island log, which is in Pearl Streets. And as it's coming down, the water's with us, going to Surges Narrows. But when we get there, the wind is changing, coming against us, and there's a storm coming. And as we head off through these fjords, you can imagine how long this raft is, 1,200 feet long. And they are sashaying it, pulling it with a stern to get through the buoys. And the closer we get to the other end, the more the water is going into white caps, and the buoys are starting to go under. And we're going more and more power on this 81-foot tug. It didn't look good. We're hardly moving. And it's getting worse. And all of a sudden, a toggle pulls out of one of the logs, and the log bundles start coming out. There's 4 men on this boat. One's a skipper, 2 guys, one mid-40s, that he's about 300 pounds from Yakutat, and the other one's one real healthy, and there's me, 23 years old. They said, we want you to go out on the logs, take a boom chain, and you've got to drag this line, 2-inch hemp line with a hook on it, put it through the ring on one, run on the log booms, and it's snowing. The wind's blowing. They get around to the other side, straddle it, put the chain through it so they can suck this big open gap up. And there's the bundles are coming out of the raft. Okay. Yeah, so I get down and I'm running, and mind I'm carrying 100 pounds of shackles in my pockets, and the log, the waves are coming over, and some of the bark's not good. And I finally get around, I can run the rope through the front boomstick, and I'm running the log raft, so they get around. I'm laying on this log, and the water's coming over, and I got this shackle and pulling the toggle through, and I hook the line onto it so they can pull it up, and I wave in the water. They've got a 5-mile line on me. And I stand up, and he hits the bundles to shove them back in the open connection, and it hits my boomstick and puts me in a broad wash. I went down like a leaf. I went under the log raft. It's all white. I can see the top because the light's above the raft. And I just remember I was a diver. I swam up to the top, and the raft, the logs were smashing together. And I keep having to go down, but I keep getting air. And finally, these logs, there's 20 in a bundle. They're not always symmetric like Lincoln logs. Some of them are crooked. And I rolled on top of one as it squashed together. And I pulled myself up with that 2-inch banding. And the snow's on there. Every 100 feet in tow, you've got to have a lantern. And I pulled up the lantern and wrung out my Mackinac and put it underneath for a core. And I waved at them, and they could see I was okay, because they still had to go through another set of buoys. So it was about 10 minutes of me trying to just keep breathing. And I finally got outside, and they got to skip the tugboat up. And when they did, the two older guys got off and helped me on the boat. I was so cold and stiff, I couldn't walk. And they put, you know, hot towels on me and feed me coffee. And that night I quit. When I went down to the hole to get my stuff, I met the young guy who was replacing me. Kind of looked like Derek a little bit. He was a big kid and 22. I had turned 24 on the boat. And 1 month later, that boat sunk. Derek was the only one to get off. And there was a storm warning. And I no, the skipper, because he always said, we can do this. He just was infallible, but that was January 15th, 1974. The boat was the Martin D. Somehow sick. So, pay attention to storm markets.
Galley Table Storytelling is made possible through a partnership with the Kodiak Arts Council and Kodiak Public Broadcasting Corporation. Visit us online at galleytables.com to find the date and location of the next live storytelling event. You can also browse our archives and listen to past stories or sign up to be a storyteller. Galley Tables, sharing stories and sharing life.